page 18, chapter 22. Now, the Wilcox expedition both started from the area of Wonder Lake, and they both walked to McGonigal Pass together as a crew of 12. That's a correction on that. That's a chapter 21. My mistake. Now, they didn't walk from opposite directions from Talkeetna and from Wonder Lake. They both started from Wonder Lake area, came through McGonigal Pass, went up the Muldrow Glaciers, up to the Harper's Ice Fall, above the Harper's Ice Fall to the 16,000 foot level, where five of the strongest, including Wilcox, decided to make a summit attack, which was successful. Stop. Chapter 22, page 21. Now, on the Wilcox's victory celebration at 10,000 feet, I do not know that they had such a victory celebration, and I'm perturbed but not bitter, and I don't want to quote in that line because I wasn't there when they arrived at the 10,000 foot level. Chapter 22, page 21, a Wilcox, or rather Babcock's bottom of page, permission was an 8,000 foot airdrop on the Muldrow. So that was accomplished, 8,000 feet on the Muldrow, not 10. Chapter 22, pages 24 and 25, on discovering the bodies east of the Archdeacon's Tower, I immediately established that it was a hand twisted, and it was an ice axe, and it was a sleeve. And then I circled back up to 19,500 feet, where the Babcock expedition, miraculously, were just topping off the top of the Archdeacon's Tower West Approach. And at that time, right then, within 15 minutes of the discovery, was able to drop Babcock, who were at this time at about 19,200 or 300 feet, the note on the paper bag, complete with the surveyor blue ribbon tail, right in the middle of the climbing expedition. They went after the candy bars, then noticed the map, and then all made a passiar towards the location.
Apologies. All preceding corrections were for Chapter 21. Stop.
Page 22, page 11. Janae told me on his return from Sanford that on his request for a helicopter, they sent one up in the middle of the night
and
instead of the following day. And so it was the same day in the middle of the dark night that the helicopter came in and picked him up. Chapter 22, page 15. This is not one of those easy dozer deals where I was plucked from the glacier. Let me explain what it involved. The plane was on its back, mangled. The battery acid was pouring out of the batteries sections. The cells of the battery was draining sulfuric acid on the rest of the wreckage. My job was to take the battery out of the battery box, and it was becoming dark and overcast also, I might add. Also, in order that you activate the radio, you must hook the battery up and hook it up right. Now, in the dark, you have to hook the radio up backwards to have it right. That is plain to see. If you have something such as a battery and turn it upside down, you will have to use the opposite appearing terminals to hook the thing up correctly. If you do not hook it up correctly the first time, you blow all the transistors out of the radio. So, the biggest job of that expedition was to hook up the battery in the dark, backwards, and keep the thing in mind that if you hooked the battery up backwards, you would have an inoperational radio. Now, I'll say that again. Since the connections are limited in their length of cable, this has to be a one-shot deal. It has to be done properly. Fortunately, I was able to figure the thing out in spite of a big bump on my head and coming darkness. And on my first try, when I heard the C-130 go by, I got a good radio contact and gave him a good location. He at the time was 10 miles to the southwest, and I talked him in overhead. And he contacted that chopper. One of my old friends came roaring in there about 2 o'clock in the morning, and it was then, not as if by magic, but 4 hours later, that I was able to ride away on the helicopter. In regard to the darkness, it's caused by several things. Overcast, blowing snow, and then darkness of the low latitudes of the sun itself. Chapter 22, page 17. I'd like to elaborate on the fact that Dan Cuddy, president of the First National Bank, had for years been on sheep hunts. Now, when you go sheep hunting, there's no guarantee that you'll get a world record or even a big sheep. And he, luck had escaped him for years, and he had seen several large sheep but never been able to get close enough to one to even take a picture. But anyway, with the expeditions of the Wrangles, of the Logan, the Nazina, and the Katsina, and all the beautiful area of the Wrangell Mountains, this is the home of the world record doll sheep. So I related this fact to Mr. Cuddy and told him that on hauling, climbing, and geology expeditions in this area, I had often seen these tremendous world record rams. So we wound up by going on this particular sheep hunt. And as we landed on the glacier at about 7,800 foot elevation, I had taken along some tie downs, which were again buried in the glacier ice against the possibility of wind, and also under the skis, I had chalked the aircraft skis up from the ice so it wouldn't melt down or freeze down. At any rate, this was a tremendous asset as we staggered back up glacier after the sheep hunt was discontinued after the fall, and arrived finally the second day. It took 2 days to go 16 miles. This a rock fall is the worst kind. You get cut and bruised and lacerated, and it's extremely painful. At any rate, the gear was retractable skis.
First time he'd ever landed on skis.
Well, but the thing was, there's some important details. One was that Dan Cuddy had in his career as a pilot many thrills. Now, all of these thrills weren't flying thrills. Whenever I would hit the bank with ideas of high finance flashing in my eyes and thinking of valuable new airplanes, there was always two thrills attached to the transaction. One was when I got the loan, and the other was when I paid Dan Cuddy, First National Bank, back. Okay, we arrived back at the plane, and Dan said, "Say, I've been flying floats for 25 years, but I never, for 25 years, flew anything on wheels or skis." And I said, "No problem." I said, "I'd fly it, but I'm afraid I'll black out." And all this time, I was twisted in horrible pain. And so the takeoff thundered down the side of the glacier, and away we went. We finally arrived at Gulcana, which is noted for its washboard runway. And the north-south runway is an old military runway full of big ocean waves. But anyway, Dan sneaked up cautiously, full power. We went over one of these ocean waves, and he had the skis retracted and the wheels down, and we negotiated the first ocean wave and went skyward again. And he says, "Shall we go around?" And I said, "No." He said, "Just chop her, and that's a good landing." And it was a good landing, and from there on, I finally, on the third day, made it to the Providence Hotel Anchorage. At any rate, because of Dan's skill as a pilot, I was able to safely return from the high-altitude glacier of the Wrangells. Chapter 22, page 20. Now this lower middle page, Weizikoff was in radio contact, Citizens Band radio with Eielson, the park, not the Air Force. Chapter 22, page 21, top of page. Now, the first radio call, since I was closest to Nenana, was VHF to Nenana. This was accomplished. This was VHF, that's line of sight. Okay, then I turn on my HF radio, which is not line of sight, it's an ionospheric skip bouncing ball type radio wave, and I called Talkeetna Roberta at office, and I gave her the instructions to notify rescue. This is how we got in contact with the military helicopter, who was luckily in the area northbound at the time, and I only had a 30-minute wait over the crash site before the helicopter arrived and evacuated the injured member of the aircraft, or the injured pilot of the aircraft. Now, conclusion, page 5. As far as I know, to my knowledge, no one ever salvaged the 185 on the Hayes Glacier, Upper Susitna. I went up to have a look at it and to salvage it myself, and it appeared to be covered by tremendous, huge, monster talus ice blocks from an avalanche. Conclusion, page 8. Now, there were three ministers, Baptist ministers, top of page, and as I once mentioned, I completely demolished an aircraft in 1949 because a big soft snow ski tore loose from its fittings and became loose from the front. All the check cables and bungees gave away, and the ski went down and back, creating a tremendous drag. Was unable at that time to figure out how to bring the ski up. So, 15 years later, with a different and larger aircraft, the same thing occurred. The right ski came down, broke the check cables, the bungee cables, and all the rigging from the front. This time, I had aboard three Baptist ministers, and the one closest to the door was also the largest. So we tied a rope around his waist, and they encouraged him to stand on the ski while I made a successful landing. Needless to say, there were a few kind words in addition to the words of encouragement. On the first try, the rope was too short. The Baptist minister couldn't get out the door because of the slipstream. I slowed the plane further on a second try. We gave him 6 feet more rope, and he was able to stand on the heel of the ski, bring it up from the back, bringing the toe of the ski up into flight position, and it was in this manner that we was able to successfully negotiate a landing. Conclusion, page 8. I'm unclear if we charged the Baptist ministers for the flight or not. Roberta said she thinks we did, so please scratch the fact that we did or we didn't charge them for the flight. I'm unsure.
We have just completed the conclusion, and so far this tape has been nothing but revision, correction, criticism, etc. We wish to state that the conclusion is excellent. Stop.